Flora is Gail Godwin's 14th novel. It tells the story of 10-year-old Helen and her summer guardian, Flora, who are isolated together in Helen's family house while her father is doing secret war work in Oak Ridge during the final months of World War II. A fiercely imaginative child, Helen is desperate to keep her house intact with all its ghosts and stories. Flora tells a story of love, regret, and the things we can't undo. Gail Godwin is a 3-time National Book Award finalist and the best-selling author of the critically acclaimed novels A Mother and Two Daughters, The Good Husband, Father Melancholy's Daughter, and Evensong. She's also the author of The Making of a Writer, Journals 1961 to 1963, the first of 2 volumes. And it's always a pleasure to have Gail Godwin on The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. What a delight.
You're welcome. It's always a pleasure for me, too.
I love this novel, and I love the story. What brought you to this particular time period?
I wanted to do a story of an isolated little girl, and I did want it to be set at the end of World War II because she causes an emotional explosion, which then becomes more than that. And I wanted to have that backdrop of her father, meanwhile working at Oak Ridge, doing secret work for the bomb.
And when you think of this little girl, what is there about that idea of her being with her caretaker for 8 weeks that it's very enclosed in concept?
Yes. I wanted an enclosed situation. I'll tell you, for years I've had a fascination with Henry James's The Turn of the Screw. And that is about, as you know, a governess coming to take care of 2 children. And it's very, very isolated. And in James's story, it's the governess is the haunted one and is the one who is in control. And in mine, my 10-year-old girl is haunted, and she feels vastly superior to Flora, who is her mother's cousin from Alabama. And also, Helen feels threatened because she's lost most everybody, and all she has is this old house, memories of her grandmother, and memories of her grandmother's stories about all the recovering alcoholics and mental cases that lived there with Helen's grandfather, who was a doctor. So I had it set up that way.
The relationship between Helen and Flora is so essential. And you made the connection to Turn of the Screw, and many have also made the connection between this and your previous novel, The Finishing School, of being somewhat reminiscent of that. Was this a story that had been in you for a long time?
I always knew I was going to do something with that house someday. Funny enough, when I was researching my old journals for the Making of a Writer, I came across an entry when I was in Iowa at the workshop. I had just sent off my first novel for publication and was eager to start something else because I was very hungry for success. And I wrote this note to myself, 1000 Sunset Drive. That girl, that summer, children are like bombs that will one day go off. And there it sat, and then I forgot about it. And then when I was rereading these journals so that Rob Neufeld could edit them, I found that. And it connected with something else that I had just heard. I heard a movie maker talking about a ghost movie he just made, and he said, children are like, every adolescent mind is a haunted house. And that kicked in. And then I realized I wanted to write that next because I have not finished with girls. And that mind of a child who's just on the verge of adolescence and has her brain is there, but she doesn't have the experience to back it. And so she comes into this surge of power and yet can't imagine the consequences of it once she uses it.
The age difference is interesting between Flora and Helen, because Flora's really only 12 years older, right? 10 years
she's,
older?
Flora is, wait a minute, Helen is 10,
Flora's
going
like
on
22.
11, and Flora's 22, so there really isn't that much difference, and probably the father would have preferred to get somebody a little older if he had had the time, but he had to go up to Oak Ridge and do his summer's work.
And when you think of this, of the relationship between the two, and obviously the family and the fact that her mother did pass and she's dealing with this grief, and that plays very much into the emotion and into the story.
She has just, Helen has lost her mother a long time ago when she was 3 years old, but she just lost her grandmother, which is why she needs someone to stay with her. And her grandmother was quite a force in her life. The grandmother told stories and told everybody how they should behave. And Helen is holding on very tightly to that world and to that grandmother. And so she goes and sits in the grandmother's garaged car, plans to wait it out for the summer and endure Flora. Unfortunately, the isolation becomes a volcano. And
without giving anything away, which is difficult, but your portrayal of that boredom is beautiful, because it's
hard to do. Yes, without boring the reader.
Right. I would assume that was a challenge.
It was, because I had to really make the reader feel this was boring. And when you're 10 or 11, you cannot stand boredom. And yet at the same time, this that had to be used in storytelling, in my storytelling, to show how the boredom increased the intensity both of Helen's daydreams and plots and plans, and also the interactions between the two, the girl and the woman.
How much did you want to include the father and have him be a presence off stage or on? Did you decide that early?
Yes, that's why I wanted to get rid of him and get him out of the house. And he's an acerbic, cynical high school principal. He does his best, and he also is an alcoholic. But at Oak Ridge, he can't drink, so she's grateful for that her father will be going somewhere dry. But again, I was remembering in the turn of the screw, the governess is hired by the uncle of these children, and he says, "Just take care of them and don't write to me. I don't want to." Just what he says. What he's thinking is, I don't want to be bothered. And the father wants someone to take care of her so he can go and make some much-needed money for the summer.
Helen tells the story. She is our narrator, but she is in her 70s in telling the mm-hmm. story. She is looking back. At what point did you make that decision, that you wanted this to be the recollections of a woman and an older woman?
I made that decision when I decided I wanted to set it at the end of World War II. And then I wanted to give Helen time to grow up, have a few breakdowns, become a novelist, live a life which we never find out much about, and then start to consider whether she can grow into a kind of remorse that will be constructive and will serve life somehow rather than just wallowing in it. Because she does feel remorse about what happened with Flora.
Is there a sense of bringing us to, of getting the father out of the way, as you say, and leaving us in the house with these two, that basically you want to sequester us?
Yes.
with them?
As much as I could, so that I could see the child's mind working at full tilt, and also to show which you gradually see. What a simple-hearted and pure-hearted woman Flora is. And she's a very lovable person, but she's probably one of my first major characters that I ever got interested in who didn't have an agenda. She just wants to do her best and be up to the task and be brave and be a good person. And she's trained to be a teacher.
And boy, can that be annoying.
Oh, boy, yes. And this little girl just is too sophisticated and too snobbish. And one of the sub-themes of the novel is how the outcome of the summer serves to de-snob the little girl.
And simple things like Flora doing housework and her bare feet would drive this girl crazy.
Her bare feet, because Helen's grandmother went to the, in those days it was called chiropodist instead of a podiatrist, and she would go and have her nails buffed and done, and Helen would wait for her in the waiting room and look at other women's feet. And here's Flora, who hasn't done anything to her feet. And the toenails turn up a little bit at the tips, and Helen thinks it's like they're trying to be too friendly. And then she remembers her grandmother saying once that the chiropodist told her that she had arrogant toenails, and Flora's are just the opposite. So it gives me a chance to really get into those small snob class differences, history, mock history, makeup history, and ghosts that live in you and you don't know you're haunted.
So there's this tinderbox, and it isn't until, and again, it's hard not to give, you don't want to give anything away, but it's this tinderbox, and it's not until someone breaks that sequestration when things start to go awry.
That's right. There are very few other people in the novel. There's the cleaning lady who comes once a week, Mrs. Jones, who's also haunted because she communes with her little dead girl. And then there is the young man. He's an ex-soldier who's been mentally wounded, and he delivers the groceries to these two on the mountain because there's a polio scare. And Helen's father won't let her go anywhere. And this young man, Finn, becomes the third. And both girls, women, like him, and he likes Flora. And Helen thinks he's being nice to Flora because Flora is so stupid. So there you've got it.
So much of a hallmark of your work and what so many people talk about is the autobiographical nature of it, of how you look back at your life. Here is a story of a young girl and who becomes a writer. Helen tells us the story as a writer, and you look at your life of someone who wanted to be a writer and started keeping journals that you mentioned earlier at the age of 12. And how much of that when you write about that is conscious of exploring moments and ideas in your life, and how much of it do you think is just going back to the old, perhaps overused adage of write what you know?
I wanted to get to some emotional depths that I hadn't waded into before. There's nothing autobiographical about the story. I had a mother and didn't have a father, but the only thing autobiographical was that house. When my mother remarried when I was 11, the three of us moved to this house for the summer, and it was 1000 Sunset Drive. It's been torn down now. And it was isolated. It was 1948, not 1945. And there was a real polio epidemic. I couldn't go anywhere or play with anybody except the other two little boys that lived in the house. And a young man from the pharmacy would come up on his three-wheel motorcycle, just like Finn in my book, and bring us comic books to choose from. and candy, and we would go through the comic books and choose the ones we wanted and choose the candy, and then he would go back down the mountain. So the only two things that are snatched out of my literal past are that three-wheel motorcycle and the house. But sometimes when you go afield and make up your characters' lives and destinies, you can get closer to the feelings that you haven't done with. And in this case, it was a threatened little girl and what she will do to keep herself safe, and the ploys that she will use if she is given a certain intelligence and a certain leeway with a very kind caretaker.
And of course, at 10, cannot imagine what life can throw at you, but ultimately, as an adult, we have to deal with all of these things that life throws at us.
That's right. When you're 10 or 11, the brain is actually still growing. Your cerebral cortex, where all the good stuff goes on, is still growing, and you haven't finished your cognitive growth, but you suddenly have your sense of what you can do as a human being, but you don't yet have the sense of what the consequences might be. And so she's in a surge of, I can control this summer, I can get through this, I can keep what I have, I can protect myself. But she doesn't consider that the things she might do in a rage will have consequences that will haunt her the rest of her life.
When you think of your body of work and what you have written, I'm curious of how you define it, of how you look at it, of are there themes that you're looking to explore? Are there moments, or is it novel to novel and you don't think like that?
It's always been about character, and it's always been about human development and about people working things out or not working them out, and the complexities and the subtleties of being truly human. That's what I care about most. And a lot of my characters don't make it to be fully human, but they're always churning away in their minds and plotting and planning and worrying whether they're good enough.
For your 14th novel, is it still thrilling? This book has been getting beautiful reviews. I mean, just stellar reviews.
Yeah, I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop. It hasn't yet.
and that's, I assume that still feels good.
It does. I remember the last time you interviewed me, you asked me about when I felt power as a writer. And I said I felt the power when I was doing the work, making it up and seeing where everything goes. And then I'm in my most powerless place right now, where I am on the eve of publication and have to go traveling to a few places, a few more than I thought I was going to have to. I have given my offering, but I can do no more. I have no power now. I have no control over it. So it's a moment-to-moment thing. I was so absolutely proud of myself to drive here today without anybody with me and not getting lost once. I wanted to do this. It was a way to prove that I still had some power, you know?
And when you're ready, you'll take back that power and you will.
In 3 weeks, I'll be back. And then I'll take it back, yes. This winter, I've written a small book. It's simply called Publishing. It's about wanting to be a writer and the publishing hunger and also the condition of being a published writer. And I had a lot of fun writing it. And I have one chapter left, which is the bad chapter, the mean chapter, the bitching chapter. I'm saving it till I get back. And then I'll go back to a novel. And that's when I feel safest, like Helen on her mountain with her crumbling house. I feel safest when I'm in control of my imagination.
I would think, and not to get overly psychological, but it seems
go
as,
ahead. Go
it,
ahead.
It seems as though bitching wouldn't come easy to you.
Oh, I'm just hoping, you know, now that I'm in my seventh decade, that I can let myself go a little more. It's a terrible burden to be brought up a lady. It's pretty horrible. But I'm tearing down the walls as I go. My goal is to aim for basic goodness, do no harm, and say what I think and feel, and bitch.
and does age give you that card?
It certainly is giving me a card, yes. And it's changing my writing. This is the first book I ever wrote that I didn't show anybody till I finished it. And it's also a crisper book. I'm at last getting to that I don't give a damn place. It's been a long time coming, but I'm going to enjoy it.
Does that come also with others around you who are now gone? That it is just you, that you have survived in some sense?
I have, and I've not only have I survived some of my meanest critics and enemies and people I've been envious of, but I've also outlived people I deeply cared about, from models like Henry James, who died at 72, and my dear Robert, Robert Starr, the composer, with whom I lived for 30 years, and my mother, and these good people, these not always good, but interesting people that I have incorporated in myself. So I walk around with them inside of me, haunted, haunted, haunted.
Which is a recipe for a wonderful novelist, I think.
I think so. I think it's fine to be haunted.
This is a glorious novel. It is entitled Flora. It is published by Bloomsbury. Gail Godwin, it's always such a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure always to talk to you.
Gail Godwin's latest novel is Flora. It is published by Bloomsbury. The Golden Notebook and the Woodstock Birdcliff Guild will be presenting Gail Godwin as she reads from her new novel, Flora, on Sunday afternoon, the 12th of May, this Sunday at 4 p.m. in Woodstock. You can find out more information by going to goldennotebook.com. Goldennotebook.com this Sunday at 4 o'clock. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.